Hello, just had to start this one with a brief announcement. So exciting, McKenna and I finished The Prayer Companion and it is out, it's up. I linked it below in the show notes. It's the one we've been talking about since like December or November. It's the Permission in Prayer one. So this Prayer Companion is 23 pages of our creativity, our strategy, our encouragement to get yourself into a rhythm, a system, a season of prayer, choosing kind of a way, programming your own prayer creatively, bringing in discipline, but also like room for the Holy Spirit to inspire you. And I just really hope it blesses you. I hope you love it. So if you're listening to this, go check it out. McKenna did the art. It is phenomenal. It's beautiful. And she finished it up postpartum. So she is a real rock star. So, okay, check it out. I hope you love it. On to the show. Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Catholic Bible Pod with Mon. I'm Monica, your host. And today we're talking about a really important question. Why were the Israelites in the desert for 40 years? They had no business being in the desert for that long. It doesn't take that long to travel from Egypt up to the Promised Land. And yet there they were, wandering in the desert for 40 years. Let's talk about it. In this episode, we're going to go through the plot points, the events of Numbers and Exodus. And we're going to dive into Deuteronomy and Leviticus. But Deuteronomy and Leviticus are not like plot-driven books, and so we're not going to obviously go through them quite as intensely as we're going to go through Exodus and Numbers. But if you'll notice, those are 4 out of the 5 books of the Pentateuch. So there you go. We're gonna cover 4/5 of the Pentateuch today in about 20 minutes. I am excited. I love talking about the Exodus because it's an exciting and interesting, really interesting part of history, and all 4 of these books are really eyewitness accounts, because we believe that the Pentateuch was written by Moses. So Moses obviously didn't live in the time of Adam and Eve and Noah, Abraham, Jacob, but he lived in the time of all of this happening. He saw the Passover happen. He wrote about the Exodus and Numbers. He gave the speech of Deuteronomy. He wrote the book of Leviticus. Like, this is kind of as hands-on as we get from Moses's lived experience. So I think that's pretty cool. But anyways, we're going to start kind of in the middle of Exodus, Exodus 12, because that's when the people get freed. To sum up Exodus 1 through 12 very briefly, the people are enslaved in Egypt, the people being the Israelite people, the chosen people, okay, God's people. They are down in Egypt where they should not be. We'll talk about why they're there in another episode, but they're down in Egypt. They're too intimidating to the Egyptians. Their numbers are too large. So they're taken over, they're enslaved, and then they're there for like 400 years. And this is where the book of Exodus opens up, introducing the character Moses, whose childhood imitates Jesus's. Okay, they both are born into a massacre of baby boys. They both are saved by being sent down to Egypt. Okay, Moses is sent down the Nile. Jesus and the Holy Family go down to Egypt to live as refugees for a little bit of time, and they both are spared. And Moses is a Hebrew boy who is adopted into Pharaoh's court. Okay, so he lives with Pharaoh. He lives as a prince of Egypt. And throughout kind of a crazy story, Moses murders somebody, runs away to the desert, and thinks his time of doing anything with the Lord is over, and he lives for 40 years in the desert as a shepherd to sheep. He has a wife, he's got a son, I think he's got 2 sons actually, and he thinks probably this is it. And then in Exodus 3, God appears to him in a burning bush and says, I actually have a plan for you. I want you to let my people go. I want you to go back to the Pharaoh and advocate for the people. I've heard the people crying out under the weight of the oppression, and I want you to tell the Pharaoh to set them free. Interestingly, God does not tell Moses to tell the Pharaoh to let the people be free indefinitely. He only wants them to be free for a few days, 3 days, to go worship him in the desert and then return. He uses this family language that Israel is his firstborn son, and his firstborn son is going to model to his second son, Egypt, how to pray, how to worship the Lord. He's trying to exorcise the land of Egypt, trying to set them free from the pagan demons that they're worshiping. Because Egypt, just like many of the other ancient civilizations, had many gods. The Israelites alone had one god. Okay, so this is the charge that God gives Moses. Moses does not love it, but Moses begins to do it. He goes back with the help of his brother Aaron. All the plagues happen because the Pharaoh will not let the people go for 3 days into the wilderness. So then God ups the stakes, and then he sends the plagues. And each one of those plagues directly corresponds to an Egyptian god. So God is really exorcising the land of Egypt. He's casting out the demons. He's showing the Egyptians one by one and the Israelites, by the way, who have probably begun to worship the false idols because they have been living in the land for 400 years, he's showing them, I am bigger than your gods. I am better than your gods. Like the frogs. Frogs come. So many frogs that every time you take a step, you actually step on and crush frogs. Well, there is a frog god of Egypt, Heqet, the fertility god. So it's like you're stepping on the sacred animal, the frog. You can't do that. At Passover, they sacrifice a lamb. A lamb is a sacred, the ram god is the creator god in Egypt, okay? Ra is the god of the sun, and the darkness is the plague that destroys Ra, the sun god. The Nile river god is destroyed when the Nile turns to blood. See? So every single one of these plagues happens, and it's dramatic and it's crazy, but it's not just God's wrath, like destroying the people. There's a purpose here, a strategy. And every single time a plague comes, Moses goes to the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh says, the people can go, and then, you know, he takes it back. So the Pharaoh has an opportunity every single time to save his people from the next plague, and he doesn't do it. Okay. That was the fast-forwarded version of Exodus 1 through 12. Now we're at Exodus 12. The last plague is coming, and this plague is going to be the worst of all. It's going to be the death of the firstborn son. Moses goes to Pharaoh to warn him of this, just like he's been warning him, and Pharaoh turns him away. And the firstborn son is going to die because, remember, Moses was born into a massacre of the firstborn Hebrew sons. So it's like God doing the same thing, a massacre of the firstborn Egyptian sons, unless they do the Passover. They have this option. The Pharaoh can speak up for them, and he doesn't. So he gives his people a way out, the Passover. So much more can be said about the Passover than I'm going to cover here just for the purpose of today. It is the sacrifice of the lamb. They take this lamb, they kill it, they eat it, they wipe the blood over the doorposts, and then the angel of death passes over every single blood-marked door. Now, red markings on a door is an Egyptian symbol already, so it is a symbol of, like, good fortune. So the fact that Israel is doing the red over the doors, not as a good fortune, but it's like it's a subversion of the cultural practice, marking their allegiance to the Lord. So that's really interesting. They also sacrifice, like I said, a lamb, which if they are caught sacrificing a lamb, the sacred animal, okay, this is like, no, this is pretty bad. So they really are brave in what they're doing here, okay? And the Passover, they kind of do the ceremony, and the angel of death comes, and he kills all the firstborn sons who do not have the blood of the lamb marked over the doorposts. Pharaoh himself is considered to be a god, and so he is not able to prevent the death of his own son. So it's like even Pharaoh himself, all the gods of Egypt, even Pharaoh himself, are kind of struck down by God. Okay. And this is the beginning of freedom. Through Passover, through the blood of the lamb, the people are freed. They're able to leave. They're able to go. So they flee that night off into the wilderness to go back to the promised land that God originally gave to their ancestor Abraham. And Moses is leading the way, and it's like this epic thing. And you think, all right, this is great. So then what happens? Why are they there for 40 years? Why are there four books about 40 years. Genesis is one book, 50 chapters, and it goes from like hundreds and hundreds of years pass in that book. But we have four books to talk about 40 years. What is going on here? It's pivotal. It's a pivotal time because it's really our story, my story, your story is the story of God setting his people free. Free from slavery to idols. So in the same way that Moses sets his people free through the Passover and they go through the Red Sea, Jesus is the new Moses who sets his people free from slavery to sin through the waters of baptism, the Red Sea, and through the Passover, where he is the lamb and the blood of the lamb saves. So it's like there's a strong emphasis on this plot point of the Bible because it's our story. And this is actually what I've been working on that I want to share with you in this episode is that I have this, I've been walking through these four books in prayer, line by line, chapter by chapter, asking God to show me in my own life my story of being free from idols, from slavery to sin, from things that I worship instead of God, through Jesus' saving act, which he already did to save me. Can I accept that? Can I enter into that? Can I walk with Jesus into freedom? Following the example of the Israelites, who, by the way, did not do it perfectly. They were really a hot mess in the desert, which is what we're going to get into here. Okay, so they get out of at least Egypt. They get to the Red Sea. Two fun facts. They take jewels of the Egyptians, Exodus 12:35. They're told to go knock on the doors and take jewels. So that's kind of an interesting thing. You think that they're fleeing for their lives, yet they have time to like say, "Hey, can I have your diamonds?" You know, you wonder later how they can afford the tabernacle that they built for the Lord, which costs something like $200 million in today's world. It's probably because they have jewels from Egyptians. Okay, the second thing they do is they grab the bones of Joseph, Exodus 19:19, because Joseph, he's the one who got them all down into Egypt in the first place, and he knows they're supposed to return to the promised land. So at the end of his life, at the end of Genesis, Joseph says, "When I die and my bones are buried here in Egypt, can you take my bones when you leave and you go to the promised land?" So imagine that some four guys, probably like the pallbearers of Joseph's coffin, have to carry him through the desert for 40 years. I'm just saying, like, there's stuff here that we're not imagining correctly about this whole experience of desert travel. Anyway, so they've got the big cloud of fire by night and the pillar of smoke by day to guide them, and you know, miraculously the Red Sea parts and they get through it, and Pharaoh's chasing them, and then the Egyptians are swept away with it. Okay, and then from timeline wise, for 3 months they're in the desert. Okay, as a matter of fact, Exodus 12, God says this Passover is the first day of a new year for you. So he's starting a new calendar. So let's call it January, even though it doesn't align like that. It's not perfect like that. Let's just call it, for the sake of our own mental, you know, how years work for us, January is Passover, and they leave. And then for 3 months, they're in the desert. They're traveling across the Red Sea. They're traveling. They get manna from heaven, and they're in tents, and there's 600,000 of them traipsing across the desert, and they get down to Mount Sinai, where God is going to make a covenant with them. And let's say it's 3 months later, so let's say they arrive in March. Okay, January, February, March. They've traveled, so like April 1st, they're here at Sinai ready to make the covenant. Okay, that way you can visualize. This is taking them a long time to walk. Not 40 years, but 3 months. Okay. And then at Sinai, Exodus 24, there's this huge covenant, a marriage covenant, actually, that God makes with the people. And he throws the blood on them, and they say, "I do, I accept. If I break this covenant, you know, woe is me." And God sets up this covenant with the people. Now, in between this, just a couple of things that happen is the Amalek people attack the new, brand new, fresh out of Egypt slaves. And this is the battle where Joshua wins when Moses keeps his staff in the air, and Joshua loses when Moses lowers his staff. So that happens, which is crazy because the Amalek people literally bully and attack the Israelites like 2 seconds after they get out of Egypt. Okay, so this is why God is pretty harsh with them. So yeah. That happens kind of on the way. Not a lot of other things happen because it only takes 3 months before they get to Sinai. Okay, when they're at Sinai, it's not just that Moses goes up and gets the Ten Commandments. There is a whole covenant ceremony. I just want to emphasize this because it's not like the people were not aware of what was going on. They were afraid. They were like, "Moses, talk to God. He's going to kill us." God did all these signs and wonders. Then 40 elders went up with Moses and had a wedding kind of feast after the covenant. And then God wrote with his finger on the tablets of stone. Like, tons of stuff is happening. Only 3 months after God saved them. And this is why it's so significant and wild that in Exodus 32, Moses comes down the mountain and finds that they have made a golden calf and they're worshiping it. You know, this whole golden calf incident happens because it's not that they're unaware that a covenant happened. They are aware. But what they say to Aaron when Moses goes up the mountain is, "We don't know where Moses went. So we need you to make us a god." Like, 3 months out of the Red Sea, they've already forgotten what happened and they're despairing. And I don't know about you, but I found in my own Exodus journey, I had already forgotten that God had worked beautiful, amazing things for me. Within a couple of months, I was still back to comfort. Like, as soon as hard things happen in my life, I'm back to the God of comfort that I worship. So their golden cow was what they went back to and worshiped. That golden cow must have had a real hold on their lives. And it's displayed here because that's what they turn to. They don't turn to God. They don't trust God yet. God needs to teach them to trust him again, okay? Anyway, so they make the golden calf. Aaron gives his famous stupid excuse. "Oh, I don't know what happened, Moses. I just threw some gold into the fire and out came a cow. Like, what happened?" And Moses does two things. He grinds the cow down into dust and he puts it in water and he makes the people drink it. And then he has the Levites. Well, he says, "Anybody," kind of calls for a moment of repentance. "Anybody who's with me, stand up and fight with me and kind of avenge God for the injustice that you just had. Because you just had covenant with God, you married God, and now you went off and basically cheated on God. And so there needs to be justice. And just like you promised that you knew, you said, 'I do,' to this covenant, you knew there would be bloodshed. If you broke the promise, there will be bloodshed now." Okay. So the only people that stand up and repent and come with him are his own tribe, the Levites. Moses is a Levite. And so they come and Moses has them slay the sinners, the people who sinned. 3,000 men died that day, which, by the way, you think 600,000 people were there and only 3,000 died. So not everybody was partaking. And by the way, sorry, I know I'm all over the place here. The worship of the golden calf was not just like, oh, we're going to give some gifts and put it at the foot of the calf. The Egyptians worshiped the golden calf through orgy. So it was like not a very pleasant thing happening. Okay, so the sinful people were identified, slain, and then this is why the book of Numbers is called Numbers, by the way, is because they kept having to do censuses and count the number of people because people kept dying from plagues because people kept disobeying the commandments. Okay, so this all happens kind of a wild, crazy chapter, and this is where the book of Leviticus comes from. Leviticus is a rule book, a law book, mostly for this newfound tribe of Levite priests who kind of ordain themselves to the service of the Lord by rising up and being with Moses. Moses is like, all right, you guys are with me. Thank you. Now your whole life is going to change. The whole thing that the firstborn sons used to be able to do, firstborn sons used to be the priest of the family. Now that's going to be stripped from them and given over to this one tribe, the Levite tribe. So throughout the rest of the time in the desert, Moses gets all these sermons from the Lord. And he writes them down, and this is the book of Leviticus. And it's a lot of rules, and we don't have to follow all of them today. More on that another time, but Thomas Aquinas breaks them down into like civil, ceremonial, and moral law, and we don't have to listen to all of those, so it's not that we're disobeying the Bible if we're not, you know, growing a beard or different things like that, because they were laws for a specific time and place. And then Jesus, of course, in the Beatitudes, and later, he comments on the law of Moses and perfects it. He says things like, Moses allowed divorce, but you know, you will not divorce your wife. At the beginning, it was never meant to be so, etc. Okay, so that's where the book of Leviticus comes in Exodus 32. Going forward, there's not a ton of action because they stay put. Like I said, from January to March, remember in quotes, because it's not probably January to March, it's just the first 3 months, they arrive at Sinai. And then for the rest of the whole first year, they remain at Sinai. They bury their dead. That probably takes a long time, 3,000 people. They continue to eat manna and quails. They build the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. That's the big deal that they do, because it takes a long time. And you'll notice that a lot of this book of Exodus and Numbers is explaining what's going to, like, how to build the tabernacle. Actually, it's mostly Exodus. And you're like, well, how does this have to do anything with my life? But I found, as I was praying with it, it does have to do with my life. Like, the Word of God is living and active, and He can speak to you even through instructions for how to build the tabernacle, because clearly He cared so much about anything that would house His presence. Well, you and I are like many tabernacles. We house the presence of God. Anyways, there's a lot to go into there. But plot-wise, they stay for the rest of the year. And then the first day of the second year, they set off again. And now they're going to go to the Promised Land. They've been out of Egypt for a whole year. And the idea is that they're going to go to the Promised Land and they're going to take it over. So they arrive at the Promised Land. We don't know how many months later. I believe I've read it something like 3. So again, it's not very long. They're traveling through the desert. They're camping with all their carts and people. And of course, now the Levites are carrying this new Ark of the Covenant. And there's this whole new kind of part of their life. The way that God is asking them to worship them in the desert. And they arrive at the edge of the Promised Land. And Moses says, okay, it's time. We're going to send in one guy from each of the 12 tribes. We're going to go in, scout out the land, tell us the best battle plan. God's going to tell us how to, you know, deliver, you know, attack them and get our land back. And 12 spies go in, and 12 spies come out 40 days later, and they are panicked. 10 of them are panicked. They're like, there's no possible way that we can win. This is horrible. We are literal, like, babies compared to these people. We're going to die. And 2 of the spies say, how dare you guys not trust God? They rip their garments. They're angry. And they say, trust God. Trust the Lord. He can do this. But the 10 bad spies really sowed dissension among the people and doubt. And the people started to panic. And so God told Moses, these people are not ready to do what is laid before them. They're not going to be strong enough to conquer. They have to trust me and they can't. So we're going to punish them by giving them what they want, which is just to stay in the desert. So he says, your punishment is to stay here for a whole generation, for 40 years. You're just going to walk in circles in this desert. You're going to die here in this desert, and your children are going to be the one to go into the Promised Land. I will have 40 years to teach your children how to trust me and how to obey me. But Joshua and Caleb, the 2 good spies, you guys get to go into the Promised Land as a reward. Reward for your faithfulness, which is crazy because you think Caleb and Joshua see everybody they know die, you know, and they're like the old men of their generation. Moses doesn't even get to go into the Promised Land. Joshua leads the people. So I don't know, it's just interesting to think about. Anyway, so there they go. That's why 40 years later, they're in the desert, and all throughout the desert, crazy things happen. I think I mentioned Miriam becomes a leper because she disobeys Moses and mocks him. There's this prophet that the people, the opposing people, try to hire to curse the Israelites, and he's not able to curse them. Three or four different times he tries, and instead he gives an oracle. He actually gives prophecies about the future Messiah. Like, he's blessing them instead. He can't seem to curse them. His donkey talks to him. It's a crazy story. There is the story of the bronze serpent. The people are complaining so much that God allows serpents to go among them and bite them, and then he lets a bronze serpent heal them. What else? Oh, Moses' face like glows after seeing God's glory. This is Exodus 33 and 34. He comes back down the mountain and his face is glowing, so he has to actually veil his face. Moses appoints 70 under-prophets to handle administrative things and to settle arguments. So near the end. Let's talk about near the end of their life sentence. Sorry, their 40-year sentence. So their people are dying off, right? And they're burying them. And the younger children, that generation is rising up, and they're going to be the ones to enter into the promised land. They're very near the end of their sentence. Okay, it's Numbers 25, this story happens. This is kind of like a golden calf part two. They're near the end. They're literally probably like 39 years into their 40-year sentence, and they're camped out on the plains of Moab. Moab is a pagan place that worships Baal, and the Israelites are encamped there to destroy them. And when they are there, the Moabites come across the desert and seduce the Israelite men and get them to play the harlot to God and not only sleep with them and disrupt their family life, but also worship their foreign gods. Okay, that seems to be the kryptonite of the Israelites, pagan gods. And again, you might think, what does this have to do with me? Well, I don't know about you. My kryptonite is like sugar and snacks. I can't resist it. Do I go to God when I'm feeling upset, or do I go eat a Snickers bar? You know, like, I always return to my minor gods. So these people are always returning to their minor gods. Okay, so this story happens in Numbers 25 where, you know, the Moabites are forbidden. Like, do not go make families. Do not go associate with people who are pagan. Don't do it. Stay pure. Stay clean. This is the whole book of Leviticus. It's all about this. And one guy comes in with a Moabite woman in the presence of everybody and goes into his tent in the presence of everybody. And they know, you know, what they're doing in there. Okay. And Phinehas is a high priest. And he's like, no. We're not going to do this. Not on my watch. So he takes a spear and he literally pursues them into the tent in the sight of all the people. And in the midst of the act that they are doing, he shish kebabs them. He spears them both on one spear and he kills them both. And God had begun to send a plague among the people to punish them for their infidelity in Moab. And the plague stopped because God said, oh, that was good. Thank you, Phinehas, for avenging me, for being just on my behalf. 24,000 people still died on the spot. They had to do a whole new census. Big bummer. But at least not more people died because Phinehas actually saved the day. So I call that Phinehas's shish kebab of justice. But like, have you ever heard that story? This crazy story that happens, right? Anyways, all these crazy things happen. Finally, this whole story happens that Moses is not permitted to go into the promised land. Okay. At the beginning of his life in the desert, at the beginning of the Exodus, he needs to get water for the people, and God tells him to hit the rock, and the rock comes forth with water. And then they're back at the same place, and Moses clearly has changed. His disposition is different. He is way more tired of the people complaining. And it's like he already knows this rock. He already knows this problem. But the same kind of story happens again. And God says, Moses, speak to the rock and tell water to come from it. But Moses doesn't. He disobeys and he hits the rock and nothing comes out. So then he hits it again. And in that moment, God says, all right, Moses, you disobeyed me. And it's not just like a petty disobeyment. Like, I told you exactly what to do and you didn't do it. Why didn't you do it? You're not going to go into the promised land. There's going to be a consequence for this. So it's a really kind of sad story and like a, wow, okay, even friends of God, we got to be warned that even if you're tight with God and talking to him every day and you love him and you're doing good things for him with your life, that doesn't guarantee that you can just sin. You can just disobey him or selectively choose which laws to follow. So anyways, he does not get to go in. So this is where the book of Deuteronomy comes from. Deuteronomy is the speeches of Moses to prepare the people. It's called the second law, Deuteronomy meaning two. Second law It's not the same law book as Leviticus because it's got some narrative. Chapters 1 through like 9-ish are like retelling stories that happened already in Leviticus, sorry, in Exodus and Numbers. So again, you're reading Deuteronomy, you might be like, wait, I thought the Ten Commandments already happened. Yeah, they did. This is a retelling. This is him reminiscing and saying, remember when? Because he's a really good speech giver and he's reminding them and encouraging them. The book of Deuteronomy, I'm going to do a whole separate episode on it, but it's honestly, it's like a pep talk. It's like, remember what God has done. That's the whole thesis. If you could sum it up in anything, it's remember. Remember what God has done. The Deuteronomy has the Shema, that famous prayer. Remember, remember. I actually don't know it off the top of my head. I should. But anyways, it's like, teach your children, keep it on your doorposts. Remember, because you're about to go into the promised land. And it's going to be difficult. And God has spent 40 years trying to train your hearts to trust him. But in order to trust him, you have to remember what he's done. So let's not forget. So that is kind of Moses' last hurrah. Joshua is really built up in that in Deuteronomy, told not to be afraid. He can do it. He's commissioned. And then that kind of ends the desert years. That ends the Pentateuch. Deuteronomy is the final word. If you turn the pages into Joshua, we'll just peek forward just a minute because it's an interesting couple of chapters here. At the beginning of Joshua, they go in, and the first place they have to conquer is Jericho. But before they conquer Jericho, a couple of interesting things happen in the first couple chapters. First is they cross another body of water, the Jordan River. Okay, so they already crossed the Red Sea. This is different. They're crossing the Jordan River into the Promised Land, and the Ark of the Covenant goes in first, and the water parts, and they go through. So again, you're kind of seeing a, okay, we're remembering that God has done this. We didn't live through the first Red Sea crossing. Maybe they did. Maybe they were children. But now we are living through this one. And then before they move on, Joshua says, okay, let's stop and let's erect this little like tower of stones. So to remember, it's memory stones, to remember what God has done, to mark this spot. Because Joshua was there when 3 months after the Red Sea parted, the people forgot about God and worshiped the golden calf. He was there. He remembers. So he's like, let's try to prevent this from happening again. Now, he's not altogether successful. The conquest of the Promised Land is very messy business, but like he at least is trying. He is understanding the Shema, okay? And they go forward, and before they go to Jericho, they do this very interesting thing. They all get circumcised. And it's interesting because, you know, this is covenantal law. This is from the time of Abraham. All the men are supposed to be circumcised. But like, why weren't they already circumcised? Why weren't they circumcised 8 days after birth, like they're supposed to be? Why did Moses not enforce circumcision? So you start to think, okay, this provides a little bit more context that Moses wasn't just this really innocent guy who made one mistake and God really cursed him to not ever enter the promised land. Moses was slipping. He was letting things that God told him to do not happen. Joshua's like, all right, let's clean up our act. Let's be totally faithful covenantally to God because we're about to rely on him to get into the promised land. So Joshua cleans up the act. They all get circumcised, which is must be a bad day for all of them. And then they all have to, you know, recover for a little bit. And then they go in and they conquer Jericho. And as you know, Jericho's conquering is not typical. It's not like through warfare. They just march. They march and shout. It's a procession. It's a liturgical victory. It's not a military victory. And that's how God works. He has trained them to expect the unexpected. And even though they don't always do it, God is trying to show them, I am not the same type of thing that you are. I work differently. I'm powerful. I can do anything I want to do. We've got here at the beginning of Joshua this amazing story of Rahab, and I'll kind of pause here because this was supposed to be only about Exodus. So anyways, if you made it this far in this episode, amazing. I hope that you've enjoyed kind of hearing these stories as much as I've enjoyed telling them. I think it's so cool. I think it's so cool because I didn't know before kind of diving in here through my study of the Old Testament that God spent 40 years trying to win the trust of his people. It gives me a new lens for Lent. Lent is coming up. I know it's January, but like if you start right now is the time where people start Exodus 90 or Fiat 90 or any of those 90-day countdowns to Easter that happens here like in January-ish. And the whole idea of Easter, or sorry, of Lent and kind of extending your Lent into Exodus is the idea of letting God win your trust again, removing those idols that you cling to for comfort and letting God be the one to that you cling to. So if you resonate with that, if you feel like I have idols in my life, I have sin that I'm addicted to, or I have sin that I'm enslaved to, I've just have bad habits I'm enslaved to. For me, my Exodus literally was an Exodus of health. It was like, okay, I looked at myself and I was like, I don't have healthy habits. I succumb to any time I want to indulge my body. I'm not disciplined. I'm not fit. I'm not even a healthy, like, body composition. I need to shake off and be free from literally the idols I've made in my life to feeling comfortable and feeling like, you know, it really was just comfort in so many different forms, and saying yes to myself instead of saying no. We're going to use our bodies to honor and dignify God and to be able to do our vocations well. Anyway, so if you're interested, please go check out my new prayer companion. It's called My Exodus, and it literally just walks you through. It gives you a thing to read, a chapter of Exodus and Numbers, and it kind of does Leviticus briefly, and then it sets you free to do Deuteronomy by yourself. But it's a guide, and it's reflections, and it kind of helps you go through your own Exodus. And if you're not quite in the space where you want to do something as intense as Fiat 90 or Exodus 90, maybe this is a softer option where you're praying through it, and you can do whatever fasting you feel called to do alongside it. So check that out. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope God really is able to access you and access your heart through the story of the Exodus, because it's not supposed to be a story that's kind of hard to read and distant and far away. It's supposed to be the story of your own heart and God wooing you and romancing you. Lent is the season of God's bridegroom love for you, actually. It's an engagement period before the wedding at Easter. And I hope that you're able to receive it as such. Okay, see you next time. Bye.